Let me ask you a question. When you hear the term apple orchard, what comes to mind? Yeah, pleasant thoughts, right? Nice apple blossoms, good smells. Everyone loves apples, right? Well, the word for apple orchard in Spanish is manzanar, and the connotation today is not so positive because, you see, manzanar is the name of an American concentration camp where Japanese Americans were incarcerated during the Second World War without any due process at all. And last summer, with my son Tom, I visited that place called Manzanar. It's your weekly constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and it's all about justice.
Welcome to your weekly constitutional, hosted by Professor Stuart Harris and produced in partnership with the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier.
If you're a longtime listener, you've heard my son Ben appear on the show several times. He's a student at the University of Virginia, and I've made references to the fact that I have another son. His name is Tom, and you've probably wondered why I always favor Ben and ignore my son Tom. Well, it's not my preference. You see, Tom is way off in California, where he's a Caltech graduate. He's an engineer, and simply don't see him as much as I see his brother. But recently, I made a point of getting out to California and visiting Tom. And of course, whenever I travel, I make a point of looking for constitutional destinations nearby. And when I looked at a map of Los Angeles, I immediately saw a place I had to go. And I have to admit that I went there with some degree of reluctance and trepidation because, you see, it's a fascinating place, but it's a very sad place. It is the site of one of the primary American concentration camps. Yes, you heard me right. And again, if you're a longtime listener, you know we've talked about before the subject of the Japanese-American incarcerations during World War II after Pearl Harbor. But I've never, ever been to any of those camps. But a few of them are preserved, and one of the primary ones that is still preserved is in Manzanar, which is a few hours northeast of Los Angeles. So when I was out there with Tom, we went out to Manzanar under the auspices with the assistance of a wonderful woman from the National Park Service. Her name is Alyssa Lynch. And we'll hear from Alyssa a little bit later. But right now, we're going to reintroduce the general subject by going back to an older interview we had when we did an episode on another American concentration camp called Tule Lake. And that time, we spoke with a woman named Barbara Takei.
They're being told to leave their homes and their communities. And the government created these concentration camps to house them. The government created all of this euphemistic terminology. So in addition to treating anybody with a Japanese face as somebody who is loyal to Japan rather than loyal to the country that they have chosen to live their lives and raise their families in, they're treated as untrustworthy because of their faces. So there was just an indiscriminate roundup and creation of these prisons that had barbed wire and guard towers. They existed for 4 to 5 years to imprison people. So there were 110,000 people of Japanese ancestry who were removed and placed in these camps. And they were scattered in states, Utah, in California there were two, in Idaho, Colorado, Utah, Wyoming, two were in Arkansas, there were two in Arizona.
Are any of these camps preserved?
Yeah, there's a preservation effort going on at most of these camps. And Tule Lake is now part of the National Park Service. So the Park Service is going to be preserving Tule Lake. Manzanar is already a Park Service site, and there is a beautiful and really wonderfully done visitor center that's in Southern California.
One of the first people I met when I actually got out to the Manzanar concentration camp, which is now part of the National Park Service, so it's a historic site, was a woman who is in charge of the entire place. Her name is Bernadette Johnson.
As a new superintendent, I've only been here a year, but I came to Manzanar as a member of the public before I worked here. And it's truly just a humbling experience to be the site manager, but mostly it's really about people's lives. Mm-hmm. And we are in a fragile time because there are people that were here during World War II that are still alive and have memories of being at Manzanar. And so for me, it's really about learning from those individuals, getting to know their personal stories, and then really thinking about ways that we can make it relevant to what's happening today in the world. Mm-hmm. But I think we really focus here at the park at telling those stories from the personal perspective. It's not the National Park Service telling the story, but it's really utilizing either oral histories or our personal connections with people that have been here. And I think those stories and the connection to those stories keep people coming back, because this is a valuable lesson, and people continue to be marginalized. And I think specifically in this site, marginalization has occurred for hundreds of years. And so every person that walks through our doors, or people that visit our site, or hopefully people that hear your program, mm-hmm. can begin to understand what happened here and how we individually need to make changes so that we don't continue to marginalize people and violate their civil liberties.
Yeah, it's a very negative lesson, isn't it? I mean, this is basically an object lesson in what happens when we don't live up to our constitutional principles, when we don't respect things like due process of law, when we don't respect the prohibition of unreasonable searches and seizures. That's what you get. You get Manzanar. You get camps.
Correct. Yeah,
I think it has happened here. And that's a shocking revelation that there were concentration camps in the United States. Now, I'm always at pains to be very clear. We're not talking Nazi camps. We're not talking death camps. We're not talking brutality, except, of course, that it's always brutal to take people and uproot them from their homes without any due process and to deprive them of their property, to deprive them of their liberty. But it's shocking that actually happened in this country, and so I'm very glad that you all are here. What can you tell me about the actual authorization of the camp and what is actually here of what was originally here?
Do you mean from the Park Service perspective?
Yeah, from the Park Service perspective. Yeah. I seem to recall when I came in that the camp itself was established in 1992, some years after World War II, obviously. And so somebody had to come out here and say, we want to establish this as a national park.
So there were early grassroots efforts by the Manzanar Committee, mm-hmm. And they're an advocacy group and a close partner of the National Park Service. But in fact, they were really the folks that were behind getting recognition for the site.
Now, was that former inmates or was it?
It was. Mm-hmm. It was one of the primary individuals involved was Sue Kunitomi Embury, mm-hmm. and she and some others in the late 60s began doing pilgrimages to Manzanar. Mm-hmm. And it really began sort of that swell of people engaging in what had happened here. And there had been other pilgrimages from some of the Buddhist ministers in camp. They were coming here anyway. But in the late 60s and the stuff that Sue Embury did, it really was sort of that catalyst that brought it to that next generation of folks. And they really rallied first the city of Los Angeles, because the property was owned by the city of Los Angeles. And so there were, you know, different designations that started to happen. In the 70s, there was the designation of the site as a state landmark. Mm-hmm. And then later it was listed on the National Register. And that's probably the first time the National Park Service became involved, just because we're the keeper of the National Register list. But those efforts continued to move on, and eventually there was some, I think, you know, obviously I wasn't around then, but there was a lot of effort that moved folks in the direction of maybe the National Park Service was the right person to be the caretaker of the story. Mm-hmm. So it actually wasn't designated until 1992 as a National Historic Site. And there was a lot.
Was there much left here at that point?
So the actual physical buildings that were left on the site were the auditorium, which we're in today, and then the obelisk at the cemetery, mm-hmm. and then two sentry guard posts. That's sort of the extent of the built environment. There mm-hmm. were lots of foundations Some of the ponds and gardens had been filled in. So those remnants were all still here as well. But as far as what was constructed on site, it was just limited to those three buildings and the obelisk.
Had the other things been torn down, or was it just the passage of time and the buildings had collapsed and deteriorated?
No, after in 1945, when the when Manzanar closed, then there was a very concerted effort to demolish the camp and return it to the condition it was in before the camp had been established. So a lot of the buildings were moved off the site or demolished.
Very interesting. Okay, well, what am we going to see today? We're going to go outside, and you've got some exhibits out there, don't you know?
We do. We have some replica barracks. Two that are out there represent early development, so the 1945 conditions that folks would have been subjected to when they got here, and then a later version that tries to replicate the conditions in 1945 when things had, you know, had been sort of personalized, if you will, by folks that lived in the barracks. As much they, you know, they tried to make it as comfortable as they possibly could. There's still not anything you and I would probably think about living in right now, but they made it home and they made it as personal as they could.
What's the most important thing you'd like to tell people about Manzanar?
I think the most important thing to remember about Manzanar are two things. It is a very dark piece of our history, and that it's not history, it's living history, because it's been 70 years since Manzanar closed, so we do have a fair number of people that are still alive, and the beauty of that is that we get to hear their experiences firsthand. It's not the National Park Service interpreting that story, but getting to know individual stories, I think is what makes Joe Q. Public able to connect with that individual and their story, and putting yourself in that place of someone who was forcibly removed strictly based on what they look like. Mm-hmm. It was racism. Mm-hmm. And I think that we all have a social responsibility to prevent that from happening. And it's an individual decision that we each make to ensure that that doesn't happen again. The second piece of it is that I think it was really important that the federal government, after the commission looked at what happened here and made that recommendation to the president, that there was actually a formal apology.
Right.
And I think those are two things that we should be really proud of as citizens of the United States, is that it was a dark piece of our history, but our government apologized. And I think that apology was necessary, and I'm proud as a federal employee that a government I work for could do that. And what other country in the world has done that?
All right. Well, Bernadette Johnson, thank you very much for speaking with us today.
Thank you, and thanks for coming to Manzanar.
It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week we're on a visit to a tragic but fascinating place, a place called Manzanar, which in Spanish means apple orchard, but in the event actually meant something much more sinister. It's an American concentration camp. After the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz, and then we'll come back and we'll speak some more with some people of Manzanar, including a former inmate. Stick around. And now it's time for our constitutional quiz, recorded before a live audience at James Madison University with the quiz prez, Jonathan Alger.
All right, who do we got next?
I'm Ned Sieverts, and I'm a student here.
Ned! Where are you from, Ned?
I'm from Arlington, Virginia, so just Arlington, outside the D.C. Right? area.
Just down the road, so you can go home on the weekends and do laundry.
No, I'm a good student.
Tremendous. Okay, well, Ned, what are you majoring in?
Political science.
Okay, well, that sounds like right up your alley then. Yeah. Quiz prez, do we have a question for Ned?
We do. Are you ready?
Yes.
Okay. The original purpose of the Philadelphia Convention was to A, recommend amendments to the Articles of Confederation, B, write a new constitution, C, abolish the Articles of Confederation, or D, choose the first president.
Hey, come on now. Who's blurting out answers back there? This is just like Wheel of Fortune, okay?
That's
shh!
Right.
Stop it. Don't solve the puzzles. I'm not saying that was the right answer. I'm saying that Rex has a very big mouth back there. Okay.
Well, since Professor Pete is my professor that I just came from class from, I'm going to go with A.
You're going to go with A. What was A again?
Recommend amendments to the Articles of Confederation.
And that was the one I was considering, but Pete secured my answer.
Oh, right.
This is the phone-a-friend concept.
Yeah. Is that the phone-a-friend concept? Yeah. Well, did he get it right?
And the correct answer is A, recommend amendments to the Articles of Confederation.
So people realize that even though that was the original way they sold this convention, that we need to fix the articles, especially with regard to the regulation of commerce, which was a huge issue in the 1780s, they sold it that way, but as soon as they got there, Madison basically pulled out the Virginia plan, and implicit in that was, guys, we just got to throw it all out and start from scratch. And this was practically seditious. I mean, these guys were ultra-virus. That's a fancy legal term for they were going way beyond what many of their state assemblies had authorized. And in fact, I think it was Patterson, when he showed up from New Jersey, he was like, what are you people doing? And he proposed a complete alternate plan that basically went back to the Articles. And it was only because the convention adopted a rule of secrecy, and it was only because they observed it, that people like Patrick Henry were sort of blindsided. If he'd known what was going on there and shown up, he would have thrown a wrench into this whole thing. So that was a huge issue, huge issue.
Yeah, we might just mention too, it's hard for us, to conceive of it today, but there was still an awful lot of loyalty to the individual states, much more than a sense of being united as a country, right? And a lot of it had to do with the distances, the difficulties of travel and communication at the time. So there was much more isolation of these individual states from one another. And frankly, they didn't necessarily trust one another in terms of having each other's best interests. So it was a really complicated time, and all the more remarkable when we see what came out of it.
When you think of the 1780s and the level of cooperation between the various states, think of football rivalries. Right? How much do state football teams at various state institutions like each other? They don't even like each other within the same state.
So that was kind of how the 1780s
were, and that's why we basically needed to throw out that system and start afresh. Kudos to James Madison. He recognized that. All righty. Thank you, Quiz Prez.
Came those relocation orders. They took our house, the store, the car, and they drove us through the desert to a place called Manzanar, the Spanish word for apple orchard. Although we saw no apple tree, just the rows of prison barracks
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this time we're on a visit. We're on a visit to Manzanar, one of the former American concentration camps where Japanese Americans were incarcerated during the Second World War. I went there with the assistance of a woman named Alyssa Lynch, who was very, very helpful. And when we finally figured out exactly which day I could come, Alyssa got very excited, and she said, "Oh, Saburo will be here today. You get to meet him." And I said, "Of course, well, who's Saburo?" And she said, "Saburo was actually incarcerated here as a child."
My parents were tenant farmers in the San Fernando Valley. We came in here on April the 28th, 1942, and left here on October the 15th of 1945. I was 7 when we came in, 11 when we left. I went through 2nd grade, 3rd grade, and 4th grade here at Manzanar.
Wow. How were you brought here?
We were transported by the City of Los Angeles buses, and there were 40 in that convoy. That's how we came here.
Did you come up the same road we just drove up to get in here?
We came up US 395, but in those days, 395 was not as well maintained or as wide as it is today.
In fact, the drive up here was a very, very dramatic thing. I mean, on the one hand, it's a sad place. You know, there was a great injustice that was perpetrated here. And yet you can't help noticing the natural beauty as you're driving up here. It's a gorgeous place.
Well, many people have asked, you know, "Is that Mount Whitney?" And I say, "No, that is not Mount Whitney. That's Mount Williamson." Mm-hmm. Mount Whitney is a little difficult to find, even in Lone Pine, because it sits far behind. The dominant mountain there is Lone Pine, which is large enough in itself, but it sits forward. So that really takes the focus off of Mount Whitney. If you don't know what you're looking for, you'll never find Mount
Whitney. We made the same mistake. On our way up here, my son Tom and I were driving up, and he said, "I think that's Mount Whitney there." And I said,
"No,
we weren't
sure."
No,
it's usually to the right, and it's far back. And you see the, I think it's 4 jagged peaks. We have an orphanage here. We have 105 orphans.
Really?
Here in our orphanage. We were the only camp among the 10 camps that had an orphanage. The orphans came from 3 different orphanages here in California. Also.
Wait just a minute. So there were Japanese American orphans in various orphanages.
Yes.
Who were then removed from those orphanages and brought here?
Yes, there were 105 of them here.
I had no idea that you were taking orphans out of orphanages and moving them to an incarceration camp.
Yes, well, even worse. What the government said is that if you had 1/16th blood, Japanese blood, which is about 4 generations.
4 generations back, like your great-great-grandparents or something, right?
You had to be in the orphanage.
Oh, good heavens.
So, not only did they come from the 3 orphanages, but they were also pulled back from adoptive parents, foster care parents, and put in the orphanage here.
So some kid who had a little bit of Japanese ancestry was pulled out of his home from his parents and put into an orphanage here?
His adoptive parents, yes.
Good heavens.
In the 22-minute film, you will see one of those orphans. His name in the movie, and that's his real name, Dennis Tojo. He's a 7-year-old boy. He's about to be released to go to Bishop. Well, the fact is he's being adopted by a family named Bambauer in Bishop. He becomes a lawyer. He's now retired. He lives in the Fresno area. But the key here is that in the film, you'll see a quick shot of him because he's being fingerprinted. And you look at him and you say, well, he doesn't look Japanese, but he's at 1/16. He falls into that 1/16 category. Therefore, he had to be in the orphanage here.
Wow. I'm speechless. I was going to ask you about the wire. Now, the entire camp is enclosed with wire.
Barbed wire.
There are guard towers.
Yes, there are.
Now, what sort
8
of
guard towers?
Right.
There was a company of military police guarding us, which is roughly 500 soldiers.
Right.
But mainly, they stayed outside the barbed wire.
So I was going to ask you, did you have any interaction with them at all?
No, we did not. We saw them in the tower, and we saw them in jeeps on the perimeter patrol, and that's about it.
Did they have anything to do? I mean, was anyone trying to escape?
Not that I'm aware of.
Right.
I mean, when you say escape, where would they go? I mean, we're easily recognizable.
Mm-hmm.
We couldn't go on US 395 and hitchhike.
Right.
Going over the Sierras was almost an impossible task.
Mm-hmm.
No, no one tried to escape, not to my knowledge. Now, you're talking to a seven-year-old.
I understand. It's just that when I see the barbed wire and I see the guard towers, I just ask myself, what was the point?
Well, some of that, I think, was political.
Right.
Which, you know, I won't address.
Well, what can you tell me more about your own experience? You came up here as a seven-year-old in a bus. What was it like living here on a daily basis?
Well, I went through second grade, third grade, and fourth grade here. Our school was from, you know, kindergarten through 12. We had certified teachers from the outside, and we had certified teachers from within the camp. It was a mixture of teachers. I didn't have any problem when I went to the outside, for instance, when we went to Cleveland, to transition into their school system. And so with that, I would say, you know, what we had here in Manzanar was quite competent.
Mm-hmm. So that's what happened to you. You all got released in 1945.
Not necessarily.
Okay. Well, I was talking about your family.
Okay. You had to have a job.
Right.
And so we had recruiters coming in here saying, we have a job for you. You know, come to Chicago, come to Cleveland, Detroit, Pittsburgh, Philadelphia, New York, wherever it might be. My two older brothers took a job with a steel fabricating plant in Cleveland and went out in April of 1945. And my parents and I followed in October of 1945. Now, in those days or years, if you lived on a farm, if you were a boy, most likely you did not graduate from high school, because my oldest brother, for instance, received his driver's license when he was 14, and he would drive our truck from our farm with produce to the farmer's market in Los Angeles and back.
This was before the incarceration?
Yes.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And you know, he would start like 2 o'clock in the morning, come back about 6 o'clock in the morning, have breakfast, and go to school. Well, that didn't last very long before, you know, he decided I'd rather stay on the farm than go back to the classroom. So when we moved to Cleveland, it presented an opportunity that my older brothers did not have, and that was to finish high school. And then I went on to college, became a mechanical engineer, and worked.
Well, it's a coincidence. That's what my son is. He just recently graduated from Caltech. He's a mechanical engineer as well.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Worked for General Motors for 35 years.
Oh, did you?
Yes.
In Cleveland?
Well, in many places.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, we ended up in Detroit.
Mm-hmm. What, if I may ask, what part of Detroit? That's where I'm from.
Rochester Hills.
You're kidding me. That is my hometown.
We still live there.
As you just heard, talking to Saburo was just one revelation after another. We got interrupted. There were lots of people around, and so after we got interrupted, we moved to a quieter place to finish our discussion with Saburo Sasaki. Now, you mentioned that before you were incarcerated, your family was farmers.
Yes.
Now, what happened to the farm? Did your family try to go back and reclaim the farm?
Okay. I mentioned that my parents were tenant farmers.
Oh, okay.
And they could not own the land or mm-hmm. property by law. It was against the law to do it at that time. And also, by 1945, that part of San Fernando Valley was filled with homes. The farms did not exist anymore.
I see.
And so we really didn't have anything to go back to.
I see. Well, how did your parents adjust to life after the war?
Well, I think I mentioned that they had aged out to a point where my two older brothers supported our family. Mm-hmm. They adjusted quite well because Cleveland had at that time, oh, I would say maybe 3,000, maybe 4,000 Japanese Americans living there. And they had the churches. They had community activities that my parents participated in.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. Please.
And Cleveland, to me, is a very unique city in that there are probably 20-plus ethnic groups. in Cleveland, and they have a city park that's dedicated to all of the different ethnic groups, and they have certain sections of that park. And the neighborhoods that they are in, you know, are self-policing, in my opinion, and are very, you know, the homes are well kept, the stores are well kept, and the neighborhoods that they are in are all very safe. They were very, very welcoming.
Oh, I'm glad to hear that.
So we did not have any difficulties at all. In fact, the first person that I made friends with, you talk about lifelong friends, he was lifelong friend until he passed away here a couple years ago. He was the best man at our wedding.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. But that does bring up another point. Was there any lingering anti-Japanese prejudice that you encountered after the war when you moved to Cleveland?
Did I encounter any prejudice after the war? No. I don't recall anything. And I would look back through elementary school, junior high school, college. No. I did not encounter any of that. None. Absolutely
none. I'm pretty glad to hear that.
As an example, like in junior high, when you first become eligible for some elected offices and clubs or organizations, I was, you know, very well accepted. High school, same way. The various organizations that, you know, I wanted to join, I joined and was elected officers in many of those clubs. Same thing in college. Joined a fraternity because I was asked, and I was the only Japanese American in that fraternity. In my senior year, I was the president.
Good for you. Congratulations.
So, you know, I did not experience any of that. In fact, even when I worked the 35 years in General Motors, generally speaking, I did not. Except for I had one person that was, he was my boss, you know. And he was not directly to me, but some of the statements that he made were rather derogatory. Mm-hmm. But that was the only instance I had. I mean, GM's a large corporation.
Yeah, I guess there are always going to be a few bad apples, mm-hmm. right? Well, if I may, since we're in a question and answer room, I'm looking at my son Tom over there. And Tom, you just went through the film, and I know that you weren't quite as familiar with all of this as I was beforehand because we were talking about it before. Do you have any questions?
Did you ever talk about this experience with your brothers?
Did I ever talk about this experience with my brothers? No, I have not. Well, then being 8 and 10 years older than me, the two of them were, you know, very close. And I know when we moved out to Cleveland, they took me to a lot of places, different places with them, but we never talked about Manzanar. So, I don't know that they talked much about Manzanar between the two of them either. So it's something that even my parents, you know, we didn't talk about it because I don't think there was any family from Manzanar that came to Cleveland. They were mainly from other parts of California or from, like, the Washington State area that came to Cleveland. And there were some people that lived there that did not go to camp, that own stores and businesses in Cleveland.
Some Japanese Americans.
Yes.
So there was a pre-existing Japanese American
yes.
community in Cleveland.
Right.
That was actually one of the ironies of all of these removal orders, is that they only applied to some Western states. So there were some Japanese American communities in other parts of the country that were left relatively untouched by this.
Well, most of the other communities outside of the so-called, I call it the exclusion zone or the red line zone that the Western Military Command decided to draw, and that's ironic because in some cases, for instance, in Arizona, that line was drawn on the center line of a street. And if your family lived on one side of the street, and then you'd have to relocate. Whereas, say, if your in-laws lived on the other side of the street, they were allowed to stay.
Oh, wow.
So there are some real unusual situations. They did exist. And there's an exhibit out here where they talk about over 10,000 people at Manzanar, and there are over 10,000 different stories. And I like to tell the students that, you know, my story is one of those 10,000. What you hear, there's probably a lot of truth to it. It's a case of how often did it happen? Because I'm told by statisticians that bad news is repeated 14 or 15 times, whereas good news is repeated perhaps once or twice. And I tell the students coming in here, when you look at the front page of the newspaper, that's all good news, right? Wrong. It's all bad news, because bad news sells.
Mm-hmm.
So what you hear, it might have happened, but not in the frequency that people want you to think it happened. There are lots of good stories out there, many, many good stories, but they're not repeated as much as the bad stories.
Mm-hmm. Right?
And, you know, I have my own good story, and that's our family. We had a neighbor lived directly across the street from us. As a seven-year-old, I knew him as a cop. Well, he was a policeman for the Los Angeles Police Department. On December 8th, he came over and talked to my dad and said, if you have any problems, you come see me first. Secondly, he said, if you need to store anything, crate them, I will store them for the duration, which my dad did. Well, in 1943, the officials here at the camp said, if you have anything in storage, ship them in, the government will pay for the expense. So our policeman friend did that. And about 2 weeks later, we had a call from the front, not a call, a message from the front sentry. And he said, you have two visitors. Well, it turned out to be our policeman friend and his wife. Now, remember, this is 1943. You had to collect all those stamps to buy gasoline.
Yeah.
It was rationed.
It was all rationed, yeah.
You couldn't
the
just
tires,
go.
Too.
Right. And so he accumulated enough stamps to buy enough gas to travel from San Fernando to Manzanar and back. And he came up to see us, to see that we were, you know, well-treated, and that the crates that he had shipped to us, that we had received them, because he said, in all my dealings with the federal government, sometimes things went astray. I wanted to make sure that you receive your goods, which we did. And they were the only two visitors that we ever had in the 3.5 years that we were here at Manzanar. Well, about a year ago, the federal government and their archives released the census for 1940. Our daughter, who is very much interested in Manzanar and my background, looked up where we live in Pacoima, found our family listing all of us, the five of us. Then she looked up the name of our neighbor, because I knew him as a cop, but I didn't know his name.
Mm-hmm.
So she found out the name. His name is David Davidson, his wife Nadine. And she dug a little more and found out that he was the 38th chief of police for the Los Angeles Police Department.
Really?
Never knew that.
Wow. And a good fellow, David Davidson.
Good man.
Shout out to him.
Right.
That is a good story.
Yeah. And there are many other stories. You know, in the 11 years that we've been here, we have heard many other stories. In fact, there are some books in the bookstore that talks about it. One example is Bainbridge Island. Bainbridge Island is located up there in Washington, and it's located very close to the huge naval base up there. And there were 50 strawberry growers of Japanese ancestry on the island. And they were ordered off the island in a very short time. There was also a newspaper on the island, And the editor and his wife of that newspaper got the rest of the people on the island together and said, we're going to help them out. So what they did as a group, you know, they took care of the farms, they planted the crop, harvested the crop, sold the crops, paid the taxes, put the profits in the bank in their name so that they would have something to come back to. There's a book in there written by the editor's daughter in our bookstore. It's a true story. It's a fascinating, good story.
That's extraordinary. And all that work.
And you will find that there are other stories like very similar to that across California, Oregon, and the rest of Washington. It's just that you don't hear about them.
Well, I'm so glad that you've told them to us. Wow. I don't know how you can top that story, but is there anything else you'd care to add before we finish up here?
Well, I feel very fortunate. I think I mentioned this before, that my parents were not angry or bitter, because if they were, it would have soon quickly reflected on me. And then, you know, as I tell the students that come through, that invariably one of the students will ask, aren't you a little bitter? And I would say to them, you know, what good would that have done me? It wouldn't have done me any good at all. When you become bitter, it just overtakes your entire life and controls you. And you don't grow, you don't move forward after that. And so, you know, I'm very glad that my parents were not bitter. And they were a lot more philosophical. My dad's quote, I remember after Pearl Harbor, so that's a dumb thing they did. That's what he said.
A dumb thing that the Japanese did, attacking mm-hmm. Pearl Harbor. Well, yeah, I guess he was right in that regard. But it was certainly hard on you all, so I'm glad that your family made it through.
It was hard, but I think most of the people had a way of coping, a way of solving the needs, being flexible, you know, being able to adapt.
It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I've just been speaking with Saburo Sasaki, who was one of many people, many Japanese Americans, people of Japanese descent, who were incarcerated at a place called Manzanar. After the break, we will continue our tour of Manzanar, talking with Alyssa Lynch, the lady who helped me arrange my visit. Stick around. Listening to your Weekly Constitutional, I'm Stuart Harris, and now it's time for me to finish up my visit to Manzanar, the concentration camp for Japanese Americans during World War II. And we're finally going to speak to the woman who helped me arrange it all. Her name is Alyssa Lynch, and she is a ranger with the National Park Service. Alyssa actually took me outside of the visitor center and started showing me around some of the facilities at the camp.
So this is apartment one of barracks one. When the camp first opened, it was just another apartment. But they started a attempted self-government in the camp, limited self-government, because, of course, the War Relocation Authority was in charge of the camp. But they had a series of block managers who were, some people called them blockheads. So it was the apartment one of barracks one of every block had a block manager. And in Manzanar, they were all men. And this block manager's office exhibit was made possible by the donation of the family of a man named Chokichi Nakano, and he's the gentleman in the center of the back picture.
Uh-huh.
His daughter, Grace, and their family had kept his paperwork from Manzanar, hundreds of pages of, you know, block manager daily reports and letters and correspondence and thank you notes and, you know, light bulb inventories. And so she donated that to us. And so this exhibit is built on a block manager's experience and highlighting his. And we have a little flip book there that says Meet Chokichi Nakano, and it's about his family. His daughters are now in their 80s.
Well, so I'm so glad they didn't throw all that stuff out when they came across it.
It is amazing some of the things that people have donated to us. And they don't always realize how it might be used. Like in the daughter's case, she and her extended family, just came to visit a couple weeks ago. And she was amazed. And she wrote us this letter saying, I had no idea when I donated those papers what you could do with it. And
so if anyone listening has a bunch of papers that have some relationship to Manzanar or any of the camps, call you, right?
Well, not necessarily call me, but, you know, it's not just the camps. It's any history. Mm-hmm. All of us in our trunks and attics and everywhere else, you know, I know I personally have stuff from my father and my grandparents. And when I look back in it, there's stuff that goes back into the 20s and the 30s, which I don't think of as being historic because it's just my family. Mm-hmm. But you realize in those photographs and those documents, oftentimes it'll be mentioning somebody else's family. And it's been amazing to see people come here and find themselves in pictures, sometimes pictures they didn't even know existed.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so this is the block manager's office. We have the desk. We have the mail station where you'd come to get your mail. It's also a place where you could come to read magazines and newspapers. It's also the place where you got things like toilet paper and light bulbs, and where you could borrow the sewing machine. And in this actual, in Block 14's block manager office, they did have a ping pong table.
Oh, they did?
It
okay.
didn't last very long because the people next door complained about the noise.
Oh.
But we do have a ping pong table in here that you can't play because of the noise.
Understood. Very interesting. All right. And I see another block over there, or another building over there.
Yeah, one of the exhibits in here in the block manager's office is called This Terrible Affair.
Oh, yes.
And that is a exhibit about the Manzanar riot.
Yeah, tell me about that. I saw a brief reference to that in the film, I believe. And please tell me about that, because that surprised me. That's the only instance of any sort of violence or any sort of resistance that I was aware of.
There are a number of instances in the camps and work stoppages and protests. This one, you know, it's called the Manzanar Riot. We use riot in quotes. That's what it historically has been called. It's basically, well, it's hard to explain. And there's a lot of different accounts, and they rarely agree with each other.
Mm-hmm.
But it happened on December 6, 1942. A crowd of people gathered down at the police station to protest the jailing of a man named Harry Ueno. And Harry was a cook in the Block 22 mess hall. He had accused some of the WRA staff of stealing meat and sugar. People felt he was being targeted because he had complained about the staff. Well, it also turns out that there was a man named Fred Tayama who lived in a nearby block from Harry Ueno. And Fred Tayama was involved with a group called the Japanese American Citizens League, which at that time was very pro-government, you know, like, we should go to camp, this is our part for the war effort. Some people say that the JACL had people who informed on their neighbors and elderly, you know, or elder Japanese Americans. So there are a lot of politics around the JACL and who was involved in the JACL. So this guy named Fred Tayama goes to a conference in Salt Lake City, and at that conference, the JACL is saying, we want to have our men drafted to prove our Americanness, to prove our loyalty. We want a suicide battalion, basically.
Mm-hmm.
He comes back to camp, and people are not too happy with him because, you know, who was he to speak on their behalf, lobbying to have men drafted out of camp? And he was beat by six masked men. And he said that Harry Ueno was one of those men. So when Ueno was arrested, other people in the camp said he had nothing to do with it. They're just targeting him because he's complaining about the administration. So there were a number of gatherings and protests over the jailing of Harry Ueno because he had been taken to jail in Independence. And it is, again, a long, complex, convoluted story, but basically people gathered down near the jail. It was one of several gatherings that day.
Mm-hmm.
And the accounts talk about, you know, somebody shoved a vehicle towards the military police. The military police were in a line of skirmish.
Mm-hmm.
And the camp director had called them in and said, I can't control the situation, bring in the soldiers. So they were in a line. there were people in the crowd who were, you know, yelling and throwing rocks, things. There's an accusation that somebody shoved a truck towards the military police. Every oral history has some different recollection.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, without orders, two of the MPs fired into the crowd.
Ouch.
And one man was killed instantly, a 17-year-old named James Ito. Mm. Another man died several days later, and then there were nine others injured. And the Manzanar riot, besides the immediate impacts on the people involved, there were long-term impacts that affected all the camps because it got a lot of publicity. Unfortunately, it happened on December 6th, and it was...
Yeah, I noted
people,
that date.
Yeah, people said, oh, it was a Pearl Harbor celebration, which it had nothing to do with Pearl Harbor. It was, you know, months of people being cooped up together and these different factions in camp. There were strong disagreements about what was the right thing to do, you know, in responding to life in camp.
Mm-hmm.
And it led in part to the loyalty questionnaire, which ends up happening in all the camps. It increased
right.
security in other camps. So that one event here on that night of December 6, 1942, impacted pretty much every Japanese American in a camp.
So very important. Well, I'm glad you shared that story with us because I was not aware of it before today.
I was about to say that it sounds to me like you guys are actually still fairly early on in the process of reconstructing the history of this place. And you're bringing together, and to the extent you can, I mean, among the survivors, you're bringing together these stories and you're putting them all in one place. And good for you for doing that.
You know, I don't think it's something that we'll ever be able to say we've even made a dent in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have done at Manzanar, the National Park Service has done about 500 oral history interviews, including, you know, people from all 10 camps,
right.
not just Manzanar. We've done 500 interviews, which we're really proud of, and we have used them extensively in these exhibits. But when you think about 500, and then there were 120,313 people, you realize we have a very small glimpse, but it's still enough that it helps people understand.
Mm-hmm.
And our whole role as the National Park Service here is to, in some ways, be a bridge between those who lived the history. You know, we often are helping people find documents about their own families.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we print out their roster pages for them. We find photographs. So we work a lot with people who have direct connections. And then on the flip side, there are the visitors who come, some of whom know absolutely nothing about this. And they just saw the historic site sign or somebody said they should come see it. And so we get to have the very unique position of being the bridge that tries to link visitors who may never meet these people in person, but you can see their pictures, you can hear their stories.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's incredibly humbling and meaningful for all of us who work here.
And that's our show. Thanks so very much to Barbara Takei, who spoke to us earlier about our Tule Lake episode, and to Bernadette Johnson, the superintendent of Manzanar, where we visited today. Thanks especially to Saburo Sasaki, who was an inmate as a child at Manzanar. That was a very moving discussion with him. And finally, of course, special thanks to Alyssa Lynch, who not only spoke to us just now, but who was instrumental in helping me to arrange this tour and just been a joy to work with. So thanks especially to Alyssa. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our distribution engineer is Chad Barrett. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our music is by the Fifes and Drums of Colonial Williamsburg. Our constitutional quiz was recorded live at James Madison University with John Alger, who's not only the president of the university, but served as our quiz prez. Our Madison Minute is by Jen Patia Howell. My name is Stuart Harris, and remember, you are a part of the American experiment.